An excellent crowd here on Monday for the first lunchtime class, and warm welcome to everybody here on a very cold night to discuss the warmest topic we have, which is our faith, and to relearn and restate some fundamental principles. I use the word principles and not dogma. I don't intend to be dogmatic at any point during these classes and this five-week series that we're launching tonight, Wednesday nights, and again on Monday lunchtimes. But the time has come, in my opinion, critically needed in our modern Orthodox communities to begin a conversation again about what it is that we Jews hold dearest of all, what is absolutely central to our religious identity, what it is that we and our religion, our people, have taught and have professed, have lived for, indeed have died for, over the course of millennia. I want to begin to change, and in the role of our community, Lincoln Square Synagogue is a place that's really been a pace setter for much of the rest of the Orthodox community, if not the Jewish world. Famously, we modern Orthodox Jews do not speak much about what it is that we believe. We talk about what it is that we're supposed to do, how we act. We talk about the precision, the demands, the expectations, the performance of Judaism. And we so often do not talk about our first principles, about the whys, the very basics of Jewish belief and indeed practice. And in launching this class tonight, which has been, if you like, many ways long overdue in my own personal teaching, it's an effort, an attempt to change the way that we think about our own religious practice. We've, many of us, have fallen into ourselves, individuals, and as communities, fallen into a practice of saying we do what we do because we're loyal, because we're traditional, but we don't actually want to examine our religious faith or talk about our religious faith because, quite frankly, do we really know, do we really suspect, do we really believe that it's true in the way that other things are true? And I want to push back against this idea. I want to reclaim the idea of that the principles of Judaism, the anima means, if you like, the I believes of Judaism, are not anti-rational, are not counter-rational. It's not something which belongs only to the realm of the purely either uneducated, the person, a simpleton with simple faith. Quite the opposite. I want to change the way we speak about faith in our communities, and therefore change the religious nature of all our communities. And I want to do that without being rigid, without sending rigid dogmas. Tonight, it's important to state that this is the beginning of a five-week series. Each one of our classes, even though tonight is called Does God Exist and What Does He Want From Me? The truth is each one of the five lectures, What a Jew Believes, Practicing Faith in a Skeptical World, will deal to a large extent with the axioms or the fundamental belief system behind particular areas. So, for example, in tonight's discussion about religious belief, we'll talk about creation and the idea of God as the creator of the universe. We'll leave discussions, the argument from Jewish history, it's called. We'll leave arguments about our astounding story as being evidence or proof for the veracity of prophecy, etc. We'll leave that to next week when we speak about the role of the Jewish people. And the same goes for prayer. And the same goes for our class on Matan Torah and the giving of the Torah. Each class will be about faith tonight. The big question, can we say with any degree of certitude that God exists? One of the reasons, and I'll say this one last kind of introduction before we go any further, and I'll be perfectly frank and candid. One of the reasons this class is taking place this evening is because something a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, caught my eye on Facebook, where, to be honest, my eye spends quite a lot of time resting. A lecture actually given at by the JLIC rabbis at IDC, and there was a simple contention that even people who are well-schooled, who are in no way beginners or any more beginners of Judaism, need to re-familiarize themselves with the basics, the fundamentals of Judaism. So I wanted to create a course on basic Judaism for everybody, and my thinking and conversations with a number of people in the community, and this is the and this class that we read, or this series that we launched tonight, is the is the outcome of that. But secondly, maybe more immediately, one of the impetuses for tonight's class is an article that was published a number of years ago by an individual, highly respected member of the modern Orthodox community of Upper Manhattan, who wrote a paper describing, quite frankly, what he maintains as his form of Judaism, which he called social orthodoxy. And in it he maintained, now he did not say he's an atheist, he's a scare, that he secretly doesn't believe a word of religion. But what he said was he is far from sure. Far from sure about whether or not Judaism is true, quote or not, quote unquote true, and that what motivates his religious practice is a sense of belonging to a community. And that touched a nerve with many, many, many people. That ultimately we, the best we can do as educated, sophisticated Manhattanites, and as long as Fairway stays open, we will stay Manhattanites. The best we can do is to grudgingly, you know, hold our faith at somehow at arm's length and say, I don't really know if I believe any of that. I keep kosher, I keep Shabbat, I go to synagogue for a host of reasons. And that's what I want to push against. I want to actually say that despite what many of us have fallen into thinking, that religious faith cannot really be sustained on an intellectual level, I firmly believe that that is not the case. I used to strongly believe that was not the case until after preparing tonight and a few more of the lectures to come, I now very strongly believe that that's not the case. So let's begin. Let's begin, and we'll begin by discussion of does God exist? Now, I want to point out, and I alluded to this idea on Shabbat and Shul, that this week, this is a good week to begin our discussion of faith. Because discussion of faith does not make all the hard questions go away. Many people think that faith, the faith in God, is something, it's a crutch or shelter. It's a place in which you take shelter from having to confront any of the deep questions of the world. And I find it fascinating the way that the book of Shemot, the way that the Torah introduces God, the Redeemer of the Jewish people, in last week's Parsha, Parsha Shemot, God is introduced as a being with which every encounter creates more confounding riddles and indeed deep anxiety, if not frustration, than easy answers. God is introduced to us as an individual who is prepared to describe himself as somebody not listening to the cries of the Jewish people, is the individual who Moshe feels he can decline, he can refuse to go and redeem the Jewish people, but more critically, when Moses goes, infused with his new belief in God, and goes and stands up to Pharaoh and says, let my people go, not only does Pharaoh mock, but Pharaoh responds by making the life of the Jewish people immeasurably, immeasurably more difficult, bricks without straw, to the point that Moses, and our parsha, very few people understand the power, the crisis of this moment. Moshe's first encounter with God leads him to turn to God at the end of Parshat Shemot and say, you are a bad God. Lama hareota lam hazeh. Why have you done evilly? You are either incompetent, inadequate to save, or unwilling to save. And I find that so fascinating because I say I in no way want to present a small-minded fundamentalist orthodoxy. I want to show how encounter with God through our traditional sources and more importantly, through a meditation of our own private experiences leads to a sense of divine mystery, leads all of us on a personal quest of truth-seeking, ways which, however rooted in tradition, are always, always going to be highly personal, highly individual. The end of the day, I don't know if I can talk that convincingly about faith in the mind or the intellect, but through those ideas, I hope I can help us all, myself included, access the idea of faith in the heart, a deep and sincere and authentic faith that we all experience for ourselves. So without further ado, let us pick up these sheets, and I'll just point out that I phrase this in terms of a deeply religious source, Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, a revered figure in the yeshiva world, makes a point that I think every single person can agree upon, and if you meet a rabbi who disagrees, question that rabbi. You cannot prove God's existence. What I'm going to say tonight, I'm no physicist, I'm no astronomer, I'm no cosmologist, what I'm going to say tonight is a summary, the best I can understand, of some arguments in the creation debate. But even if I were a Nobel Prize-winning physics, which I now have to grudgingly accept is looking less and less likely as time goes by, even so, I would admit that you cannot prove the existence of God. You cannot prove. We can talk about small p proofs. You cannot prove it. So logically, it's impossible to prove to the extent that all other alternatives have been ruled out. But we're going to show that it's nonetheless highly, highly, highly plausible that our religious faith and our tradition and what it is that we have been brought to love and brought up to love is extremely plausible. And that's the aim of tonight's class. So Rabbi Wolbe points out from a kind of a yeshiva or from a Jewish philosophy point of view that there's another reason. God cannot allow himself to ever become the only option. Free choice is taken away when a person feels that they have no choice but to believe in God. And therefore he understands religiously as well as philosophically, it is impossible to actually believe in the way that I was speaking to a mathematician about this the other day who told me that actually 2 plus 2 equals 4 is something which is not so easy to prove either. But we'll leave that. As far as I'm concerned, 2 and 2 is 4. That's what I was taught when I was in elementary school. So Rabbi Wolbe says it is possible to prove that 2 and 2 equals 4 in an absolute way. But there is no such proof as to the existence of God. All the thousands of proofs still leave within man's hands the free will to believe or not to believe. Belief is built internally, i.e. by the individual's deliberate choice. You cannot absolutely convince an individual. By the way, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, we'll talk about this a little later on, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, a great figure from the pre-war yeshiva world, actually died in the Holocaust, returned to Europe to die with his students. He actually maintained this wasn't true, that anybody, unless they were seduced by the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, any rational individual would believe 100% in the Creator. That's something which I disagree with, and many, many contemporary Jewish thinkers disagree with as well. So in terms of what I want to do for just the next 5 or 10 minutes is to look at religiously some of the classic arguments that were used to prove in classic times, in the times of the Gemara, in medieval times, in pre-modern times, the arguments that were used to prove the existence of God and to show how really they failed to survive the test of more rational post-Enlightenment thinking. Classically, one of the arguments that people used, and maybe the basic argument, is how are we here? Where did we come from? Why is there something as opposed to nothing? That argument, indeed, is alluded to by the psalmist, alluded to in the Bible, Se'um erom enaychem veru mi bara eila. Lift up your eyes. Who created all of this? The fact that we are here implies that there is a maker. more philosophically, and this is a second source on the sheet, Maimonides maintains that the very fact that existence cannot exist without a creator, the very fact that we are here implies that something must have created us. So the Rambam writes, I'll just read this in English, this is the very beginning of the Mishnah Torah, where he sets out philosophical underpinnings for what he understands to be science, physics, metaphysics. The foundation of foundations, the basis of all form of wisdom is to know. Maimonides is specific. It's to know that there is a first existing being. Something must have called all of creation into existence. And he brings into existence every existing thing and all the existing things in heaven and earth, and that which is between them could not exist except through the reality of his existence. There wouldn't be anything if there wasn't a creator. And the corollary of that, belief in God leads to the belief in creation. There is something that stands behind everything. This is what the prophet says, for the Lord God is true. Shem Elokechem emet. True as in an imperative. He alone is the truth and nothing else possesses reality like his reality. And this is what the Torah states, behind him there is no other, meaning that there is no true existing being like him beside him. So that's a classic argument, if you like, a classic argument used in ancient times and indeed in modern times. How do I know? Why do I believe in God? Because where did we come from? Now we're going to actually see that a modern iteration of that question is extremely difficult to answer. But in terms of the dogmatic approach that humanity had for millennia of that question, that question was dealt a severe blow in Enlightenment times, actually in the late 18th, early 19th century. I'm pleased to say that the person who is most credited with putting a hole in that argument was nothing other than a skeptic Scot, no ancestor of mine, David Hume. David Hume, the great rationalist philosopher, was chatting to Professor Sinclair about it the other day. University of Edinburgh would not hire him as an academic principal because it was assumed he was an atheist, but they did allow him to become a librarian, and he got a perch or livelihood that way. So Hume pointed out, now it's very difficult to, Hume was not writing in order to appear on a rabbi's source sheets. He wasn't writing in a pithy way in which there's a money. So much of what I'm saying tonight, at least in the early part of the presentation, is based on a brilliant, brilliant lecture that Rabbi Sacks, Jonathan Sacks, gave in the year 2000 when he similarly gave a series of lectures on the principles of faith in London. And in that article he describes, or in that lecture, he describes why this creationist argument, this cosmological argument, clearly there must be a maker, a God, because after all, everything is made by somebody. Hume was able to show that that argument doesn't really hold water. Here's Rabbi Sacks' kind of a little bit chatty presentation of that. And he writes here, Hume, however, had got rid of the cosmological argument. And remember that this was, if every event has a cause, then what about the very first event? What was the cause of that? In other words, the cosmological argument therefore said, if every event has a cause, then at the very beginning of time, at the beginning of the causal sequence, there must be something which was a causa sui, no idea if I said that right, a cause of itself, and that must be God. And that's the argument. Existent, everything in the world is created by something that came before it. And Hume said, well, why must it be? Why must a series have a beginning in time? Maybe the universe just happened. Maybe there was no first cause. What Hume said more specifically was that you can't actually compare, you're drawing an inference from everything in the universe. This chair has a maker because all chairs have makers. You're comparing apples and oranges if you talk about existence. You've never met another universe. So how do you know that universes have makers? Just because you know that chairs have creators doesn't mean that universes have creators. To put it another way, a question that, and we'll come back to this, that gnaws at every, that undermines in our own mindset this question, if everything has a creator, the fact that we exist means there's a God, that begs the obvious question, which is, where does God come from? Who made God? So if you answer to that, well, no, God made himself, so then, of course, you can reply, well, maybe the universe made itself. So however appealing or however the need might be to think of ourselves as living in a world that was created, that didn't just appear by accident, doesn't actually prove anything. Now, moving on to source number four, there is a more sophisticated iteration of this kind of cosmological argument that something, we must have come from somewhere, and that's called very famously the teleological argument, the argument from design. Not merely that there is something, that there's a few atoms rattling around in the universe, but that, and particularly this is true on in our human perception, when we look at ourselves, we look at the sophistication, famously, and then we'll talk about this later on, famously, the human eye is considered to be one of the great pinnacles of this debate. When we look at how incredibly, intrinsically designed, or with apparent design, creation is, that seems to be its own argument, that there must be a designer of such sophistication. In medieval or later medieval times or early modern times, the argument used to be about a watch. If you were to find a watch lying on the ground, you would assume that this watch wasn't an accident, hadn't just created itself or happened because somebody spilled something on the ground. The existence of something so intricate is evidence of a purposeful designer who did that. More contemporary, more recent physicists have said, and we'll look at the context of that in a few moments' time, that imagine if you were to see a Boeing 747, you would not accept that it was a result of a windstorm or tornado blowing through a junkyard. Some things are too intricate. It begs belief, beggars belief, to be asked to swallow that this just happened to exist. Now, this argument has existed from ancient times. Chazal, the sages, Rabbi Akiva and others are quoted as in one way or another, whether it be a garment or be a letter, a piece of parchment with poetry on it, accredited of being, and this argument is almost obvious. So presented here in the name of Rabbeinu Bachya, a medieval Jewish philosopher, there are those, and this is source number four, there are those who say that the world came into existence by chance, without a creator who caused and formed it. I wonder how any rational person in a normal state of mind can entertain such a notion. He wrote in Arabic, this is obviously translation, if one holding such an opinion would hear a person expressing a similar view in regard to a water wheel that revolves in order to irrigate a portion of a field or garden, and were to say that he thinks that it had been set up with any intention on the part of an engineer who labored to assemble and install it, using all his tools so as to obtain this useful result, the one listening would be astonished and consider the man who made such a statement extremely foolish. Now, by the way, the argument for the water wheel, which is why I chose this particular example, actually has a level of sophistication to it, because a water wheel, we here in Manhattan, we don't really need water wheels so much. Have you ever been to, what's the name of that garden in Israel? Na'ot Kidumim, where they show like water wheels from Tanakh times, etc. But a water wheel is both a piece of technology. It's designed and calibrated to do a particular job, to schlep up water from a river and to help irrigate a field. What's interesting about it, of course, is that it's not only precise in its manufacture, but they're also located in places where they're needed. There's both design and environment. They both exist, and they're placed. So if you were to come across a water wheel irrigating on the banks of a river, irrigating an otherwise arid field, you would be struck by the sophistication and the appropriateness. There's a double level of thought that makes you, you know, question that such an idea could possibly just happen by accident. So anybody thinks that the world is such a sophisticated design just came into being by accident is a fool. He would probably charge him with lying and would reject his assertion. Now, if such a statement is rejected in regard to small and insignificant weal, how can anyone permit himself to harbor such a thought concerning the immense sphere that encompasses the whole earth? In other words, the argument from design: we live in a world of intricacy, of sophistication, of highly, highly, highly precision functioning. That cannot simply have been an accident. What is the answer to that? Oh, you're reading ahead. So, interesting. So let's look ahead. Now, I want to introduce, and this is the second time that I mentioned the name of this individual from my pulpit, quote-unquote, in my history in the shul. A good number of years ago, 12 years ago or so, Richard Dawkins, who is the leader of one of the, what's called the School of New Atheists, isn't it? Oxford academic. He at Cambridge would never allow such irreputable behavior. Richard Dawkins is a militant atheist, a militant anti-religious writer, writes a lot about science. He's a biologist. He's written a tremendous amount of evolution. We'll talk more about it in a second. I hesitate because a number of years ago, over a decade ago, he wrote a book called The God Delusion. But for some reason or other, I decided to quote in my sermon one Shabbos. I then bumped into, in the course of the week, I bumped into a member of the shul who told me, "Rabbi, I've been thinking about your sermon all week." So I said, "Okay, yeah, great." He said, "I've never heard of Richard Dawkins before last Shabbos. I spent the entire week on his website." So that wasn't such a great outcome as far as I was concerned. But nonetheless, my job is to bring knowledge and to encourage people to fortify themselves. So Richard Dawkins, a biologist, writes as follows. "The teleological argument is an argument that nearly all thoughtful and sensitive people discover for themselves at some stage in their childhood. It is indeed kind of obvious. Throughout most of history, it must have seemed utterly convincing, self-evidently true. And yet, as the result of one of the most astonishing intellectual revolutions in history, we now know that it is wrong, or at least superfluous. We now know that the order and apparent purposefulness of the living world has come about through an entirely different process. A process that works without the need for any designer, and one that is a consequence of basically very simple laws of physics. This is a process of evolution by natural selection discovered by Charles Darwin." Don't be amazed, or be amazed, but don't be persuaded by the miracle, quote unquote, that the human eye is, because ultimately the human eye is an act of evolution. As Dawkins would put it, the blind watchmaker. Some things that there is a power, there's a force, natural selection and evolution, which means over the longest time, eventually tremendous sophisticated organisms will adapt, evolve through accidental mutation, will breed themselves to a point of tremendous design and sophistication. Now, point out, and we'll come back to this, this doesn't necessarily answer any cosmological argument, it's a biological argument. Biological beings will evolve gradually through natural selection to higher degrees of sophistication. They have the ability to mutate. It doesn't, and this will become a critical point in a moment, evolution itself does not explain inorganic, or indeed does not explain what is remains one of the profound mysteries of science, how life itself appears, how inorganic material becomes living material. And it certainly doesn't answer a deeper question, which Rabbi Sacks, and we'll look at this in the second part of this in a few minutes, how consciousness arises. Biology and evolution and mutation can explain why an eye may develop, but it can't explain why self-conscious, a human being aware of their own existence, with emotions and memory, will exist in the way that we do. That biology and evolution cannot simply explain. I have to say that, however persuasive, and it's important to understand, and this is one of the thoughts behind tonight's lectures. When I hear Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and other people who represent this kind of militant new atheist school, they definitely have some powerful arguments, and they're certainly not afraid to articulate them with a tremendous amount of self-confidence and derision of religion. But it's important to understand that for all of the cloaking of science that they invoke, actually science is very much more open-minded, to use a phrase of Solomon Schechter, more skeptical to their skepticism than they would like to admit. Years and years ago, when I was a rabbi in Cambridge, it's going back about 20 years ago, more, I heard Richard Dawkins being interviewed on the BBC. And the BBC radio was asking him about one of his new books, I think it was The Blind Watchmaker, and they were pushing him on the question, where do we come from? So he said, that's an easy answer. We are evolved from chimpanzees or monkeys, whatever. Well, where did they come from? And he's able to say, we come from amoeba, the first life. Where does the first life from? Ultimately, this was quite a long interview, ultimately we come from that first atom, that first piece of matter, the Big Bang. So the interviewer said, well, where did the Big Bang come from? To which he answered, I don't know. I'm only a biologist. You have to ask a physicist. And that struck me incredibly forcefully, because it is not that even the most militantly atheist, and there is a militancy here, that even the most militant atheists have an answer. Have an answer to the great mystery of religion, the great mystery of creation. It is important to understand that they do not. They have, as we have, axioms, they have suppositions, they have positions. It's true, scientific inquiry proceeds different from religious inquiry. I'm not going to propose tonight an experiment we can do so that will prove one way or other my assertion that we live in a purposefully created universe, and a scientist can ultimately test their problem. We're talking ultimately about different forms of arrived knowledge, but nonetheless, to say that simply science has proven without question that there is no creator, has an answer to where we come from, is, and I think that we don't realize how demonstrably false that argument is. Jonathan Sacks in the Faith Lecture writes that when he went up to Cambridge in the 1960s, the idea that anybody could actually believe in a creator was something that was simply unacceptable in any kind of scientific circles. Now, increasingly, scientists are speaking in terms of the mysteries, the unknown, talking about forces that created a purpose universe that we cannot possibly really ever be able to captivate. This, what I'm going to say now is a little bit of an edit I made to Monday's class, because I wanted to say this argument just a little bit more tightly. So let us kind of survey and review where science currently is, or at least where many of the unknowns are. Now, there is an idea God is in the gaps. You know, that's a criticism of religious thinking. You know, if all religion could do is find a question that science hasn't yet answered and say that's what we mean by God, so then we're always arguing in kind of shifting sense. I want to avoid that God is in the gaps kind of argument, but instead point out that the trend of science in the last, physics in the last 20, 30 years, and I'm no physicist at all, has been to discover more and more evidence that a simple mechanical explanation for existence, for the universe's existence, is inadequate. In his lecture, Jonathan Sacks quotes Martin Rees, who was a master of Trinity College, still? Oliver Shalom?
Retired.
Oh, retired. Master of Trinity, the Astronomer Royal. Unlike the Sussexes, he has no plans to be stepping back from his duties as Astronomer Royal, as I hope. But Martin Rees, Astronomer Royal, wrote a book called The Six Numbers. And he pointed out that in creation, in physics, when you look both at the nuclear level of an atom and indeed gravity and the laws of physics that apply to the furthest reaches of the known universe, there are six numbers that all of existence depends on, for which on any one of them, even a minor, an infinitesimally small variation from that number would have meant the human that the universe would never have survived for more than a split second. The power of gravity was slightly stronger than it was. The Big Bang would have collapsed in of itself immediately. If it was slightly weaker, no star and no matter would have been able to coalesce. Whatever matter was created in that instant, regardless of where it came from, would have spun out into the furthest reaches of the universe without ever an atom being formed. So the world in which we live, and again, this is a much more sophisticated version of the argument from design, goes way beyond an ability to simply explain it away by evolution. So today I came across, and again, I'm not here judging or pairing your scientists against my scientists. I just like the relative brevity of the following sophisticated arguments. But this is from a mathematician called Amir Axel, who you can imagine was originally Israeli, not in any way, from what I can tell, a religious person. He was the author of a book called Finding Zero. He died a couple of years ago. Author of Fermat's Last Theorem. If you like, a popular science writer, a lecturer in mathematics. And he writes as follows. But has modern science, and this is from a book that he wrote called Why Science Does Not Disprove God. But has modern science from the beginning of the 20th century proved that there is no God, as some commentators now claim? Science is an amazing, wonderful undertaking. It teaches us about life, the world, and the universe. But it has not revealed to us why the universe came into existence, nor what preceded its birth in the Big Bang. Biological evolution has not brought us the slightest understanding of how the first living organisms emerged from an inanimate matter on this planet, and how the advanced, somebody help me, eukaryotic cells, the highly structured building blocks of advanced life forms, ever emerged from simpler organisms. Neither does it explain one of the great mysteries of science. How does consciousness arise in living things? These are real and unanswered questions. But much more important than these conundrums is the persistent question of the fine tuning of the parameters of the universe. Why is our universe so precisely tailor-made for the emergence of life? This question has never been answered satisfactorily, and I believe that it will never find a scientific solution. For the deeper we delve into the mysteries of physics and cosmology, the more the universe appears to be intricate and incredibly complex. Why did everything we need in order to exist come into being? How was all of this possible without some latent outside power to orchestrate the precise dance of elementary particles required for the creation of all the essentials of life? In other words, 1,000 years ago, you could look at 500 years ago, you could look at the world, even 100 years ago, and say, look, we exist. Where did we come from? And then you can invoke Hume and Darwin, etc. But the idea that reality, that creation, that existence depends on mathematical formula numbers that are so incredibly coincidental that had any of them been minor variations, nothing would exist. That is a, as scientists like to describe it, a pella, a complete mystery. The great British mathematician Roger Penrose has calculated, based on only one of the hundreds of parameters of the physical universe, that the probability of the emergence of a life-giving cosmos was 1 divided by 10, raised to the power 10, and again raised to the power of 123. This is a number as close to zero as anyone has ever imagined. Here comes a little popular science to keep you all entertained. The probability is much, much smaller than that of winning the Mega Millions jackpot for more days than the universe has been in existence. So somebody won the jackpot every day for 100 years, they would imagine that something is up with that. The incredible fine-tuning of the universe presents the most powerful argument for the existence of an imminent creative entity we may call God. Lacking convincing scientific evidence to the contrary, such a power may be necessary to force all the parameters we need for our existence, cosmological, physical, chemical, biological, and cognitive, to be what they are. In other words, contrary to Hume, not the idea that how do you know that something must have created, who says that something has to create something else? What we now understand about the science, the sheer mathematics of existence, means that it would be based on, were that not purposeful, that something standing outside of creation must have done this, created these laws of physics that they and only they can sustain life. Now, classically, what is the pushback? Not every physicist is a theist, is a believer in God. So what classically is the argument that pushes back against this?
Infinite world.
Infinite, multiverse. The idea that, okay, well, we're at the, if to put it this way, an infinite number of monkeys on an infinite number of typewriters will eventually produce the complete works of Shakespeare. To put it this way, we are, in this universe, we are astonished and amazed that anything can exist. How could it be? Can't be chance. One and billions of billions. Maybe billions and billions of universes existed, or attempts to make billions and billions were randomly formed and over infinity. And we are here experiencing this universe, and therefore we're drawing inferences that simply aren't warranted. Maybe we happen to live in that one universe that is actually sustainable according to the laws of physics. That may be true, but I point out in Paul Davis, who I'm going to quote in 1 second, Templeton-winning astronomer for Australia, Paul Davis, extremely important, not a traditional believer, but somebody who really sees purpose in creation and sees that there is profound mystery in these laws, these mathematical laws that that exist without any accounting for, without which creation would or existence would be impossible. Paul Davis points out that a belief in a multiverse, in a multitude of universes, is no more provable or disprovable than the existence of God. So a person might say, well, we're just in an infinite universe. At that point, you're merely trading articles of faith. You're merely trading articles of faith, because there's no more evidence for a multitude of universes than there is evidence or lack of evidence for a benevolent creator. I just point that out. So let's just finish this part of the presentation. So Physics and the Mind of God by Templeton Prize address winner Paul Davis. And he says as follows: certainly the existence of life as we know it, and even of less elaborate systems such as stable stars, would be threatened by just the tiniest changes in the strength of fundamental forces. The laws that characterize our actual universe, as opposed to an infinite number of alternative possible universes, seem almost contrived, fine-tuned. Some commentators have claimed so that life and consciousness may emerge. To quote Dyson again, it is almost as if the universe knew we were coming. The emergence of life and consciousness, I maintain, are written into the laws of the universe in a very basic way. True, the actual physical form, general mental makeup of homo sapiens, contains many accidental features, no particular significance. He doesn't believe that humanity, that we were created purposefully, but he believes that on some level there's no real explanation for where existence comes without a purposeful act of creation that set up these laws of physics, again, which had even an infinitesimally small variation. Nothing would exist. Now, what I'm saying, of course, by definition, is not provable. The point here is a belief in God in our day and age, in terms of contemporary science, is not an irrational thing. It is not an appeal to some kind of mystery. It is not a refusal, closing one's mind off, refusing to look at science as it's commonly understood. It's not some kind of spiritual anti-vaxxer where people are willfully ignoring absolutely settled scientific debates. Quite the opposite. There is no actual scientific proof for the existence of God, but neither is there proof the other way. And so in terms of a simple argument, is there a God or is there not a God? Or to put it a different way, is our lived experience as a people of faith and people of faith, is our lived experience, is that anti-rational? Is it counter-rational? Does it involve voluntarily choosing to separate oneself from any kind of rational scientific understanding of the universe? The answer, increasingly, is absolutely not. Absolutely not. Everything that we have seen in terms of this great mystery of how something must have set in mind this extraordinarily coordinated, sophisticated laws that summon existence into being, those ideas are entirely compatible. Entirely compatible with what we talk about when we talk about a creator. And I'm going to finish this part, and the second part will obviously be a lot shorter, but the finish this part of the presentation. At the end of the day, we have a mystery. Does God exist? Does he not exist? So remember the book, people used to quote it all the time, the nine questions people ask about Judaism, Telushkin and Prager. Must be on every Jewish person's bookshelf. I was always waiting for it used to be the eight questions, then it went up to nine questions. I was waiting for the 10 questions, never came out. So anyway, so in it he quotes Milton Steinberg. This is source number 8. The believer in God must account for the existence of one thing, the existence of evil. And we'll talk about that when we talk about prayer. How can it be that a good God, let's be honest, people's crisis of faith, and I know people who have had to undergo or undergone experience profound crisis of faith, are often far less to do with big bangs and particle physics and much more to do, lo alene, with tragedy. And that's a profound question. And I'm pointed out, we are introduced in the book of Shemot with the God that makes us question him. So the statement is, the believer in God must account for the existence of one thing, the existence of evil, and that's a profound question. The atheist, however, must account for the existence of everything else. And that, as we've seen, according to developing science over the last decades, is an extremely and increasingly difficult question to answer. Where does all of this come from? So let's turn to what is, in fact, a much more immediate question. And as I say, in each one of the lectures, please God, coming in the next few weeks, we're going to be revisiting some of the classic arguments, the moral argument for the existence of God. It's the fact that people have an innate sense of morality. Is that a proof of some intuition of the divine? We'll look at all of those answers each in its proper week. But now that we've posited in Jewish terms the fact that this world is created, and we are purposefully created, and of course the Bible's view is not Paul Davis's view that the laws of physics are set up, that life will one day appear somewhere. The Bible clearly tells us a story that this world and we, humanity, are also purposefully created. What does that mean? What does it mean in terms of my own life and my own understanding to understand that I'm not here by accident? One of the greatest, and I have to say that I tried to be as compassionate as possible in my research for this lecture, other religious, explorations. I spent some time over the years looking at reading material of the secular society of atheist groups, etc. And indeed it is a case to live without to live with the knowledge that your life is an accident is extremely burdensome. Extremely burdensome. We don't want to believe that we're here just by random accident. And when I look at websites that talk about, what then does my life, if there is no creator, if after I die, there is nothing, then what does anything matter? And the answer is, make a bucket list, look at the sunset, try and be nice to other people. I'm being a little bit dismissive, but essentially not. It's an extremely, extremely lonely and depressing existence. I'm going to say there's good evidence to suggest that the secularism, the default secularism, there's a British author called A.N. Wilson who wrote a fascinating book called The Death of God. Actually, my son saw it once on the bookshelf and he decided this must be Epicurus, so he turned the spine around from the thing. But the book, The Death of God, was a description about how in more or less the course of, let's say, 60 years, from the middle of the 19th century to the earliest 20th century, the default position, through Darwin and other things, went from a society that fundamentally believed in God to society that didn't believe in God. Fall off in church attendance, etc., in the West, something which obviously takes generations to catch up on. But there's an extremely good argument to make that the sense of alienation, that so many people have, sense of misery so many people have, is not merely to do with having too much affluenza or living in cities where unconnected to, we have to get up when it's still dark, it's somehow we're not connected to the night. That might all be true. But the idea that we live in a society that fundamentally doesn't believe in the purposefulness of life is horrific. To my mind, absolutely horrific. And the Bible tells an extremely different, challenging, but motivational kind of story. And look here, this is a lengthy quote, and we won't look at all of it, but look at this next source on the sheet. I've got a slightly different page number because I've got my little green note. But what I want to show you now is how Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in this essay that I mentioned before on faith, here we're going to start at the bottom of four, page four. He looks at the specific biblical story of creation, which is clearly not a book of science. The Torah is not a book of science. Although there was an enterprise that was popular back in the 80s and 90s of rabbis trying to read in, but Yom Echad, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, to try and read evolution or physics into the first chapter of Genesis, that's a futile exercise because the Torah does not present itself as a book of scientific knowledge. What is important to the Torah is that God created the universe, that God created the world. It's not trying to explain to us how. It's explaining that God created the universe and much more critically, why. And the argument from Bereshit, and Rabbi Sacks develops this idea brilliantly and beautifully, is that God, based actually really on Kabbalistic ideas, really goes back to Maimonides. A creator cannot exist. Can God lift a stone, create a stone that he cannot lift? No or yes? I can never remember the answer to that question. Anyway, God can do whatever he wants.
He can't create himself, make himself
not exist. So, you should come to Thursday night class. We have a lot of this. So God himself is apparently bound by certain rules of logic. And at least as far as the Kabbalists are concerned, God needs creation. The creator, perfect being, must have something to bestow perfection on. If God is ultimately love, benevolence, the power of good, then that must have a recipient. It must have a target, an object of that good. A creator without creation, by definition, is not a creator. This is Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, and many other Kabbalists take this view. And Rabbi Sacks understands that this is basically the story of creation. God creates human beings who can then have a relationship with. Creates human beings who can then choose to be people who themselves create worlds. Rabbi Sacks points out, he said it from the pulpit in our old shul, that although the Bible may give 40, 50 verses to the story of creation, it gives hundreds of verses to the story of the creation of the Mishkan, the sanctuary. Because what's important about humanity is that God, the creator, creates beings capable of creation. Capable of, like God, building places where love and loyalty and faithfulness can be expressed. And Rabbi Sacks basically says that if you read the Hebrew Bible, that is really the point of creation. I'm going to just take one paragraph. It's a paragraph that begins, "That is the only bond." We'll just read this together. It's on the middle of page five. "That is the only bond, not power, not dominance, not control, not coercion. Because if you only relate to me because I force you to, then I've not redeemed my loneliness any more than if I were just a computer doing what I programmed you to do. It is only if I allow you the freedom, but we create a bond between us. And the only bond we can think of that honors it is a bond we call marriage, which is the relationship between independent beings, each of whom respects integrity and freedom of the other, who nonetheless pledge themselves in a bond of mutuality, allowing each the space to be themselves, but saying, I will always be there for you. And that is a relationship which Isaiah calls Ish, as opposed to a relationship called Baal. Now, Sag's pointing out the fact that the audacious idea that the Torah refers to the relationship between God and the Jewish people, we'll talk more about that next week, but it's basically a metaphor for humanity as one of marriage. God says, you will not call me Baal, your master, but rather Ish v'Isha. A relationship, if you can imagine such a thing, of love, of equals. And here we come to the simple equation in Judaism. Faith is a marriage. That is the only adequate analogy we have for it, and that is exactly what the prophet said it was. Of course, Hebrew has a particular word for this, and the word is brit, and it means a covenant. And a covenant is any mutually obligating bond between two individuals, usually of an equal power, who nonetheless come together and committing themselves to one another by saying, I will always be there for you. You will always be there for me. And whatever happens, I won't walk away. That is what brit means, and that is what faith is in Judaism. That is why God always in the Torah equates idolatry with adultery. Idolatry means serving gods, which means having a relationship outside marriage, which means adultery. And so I've tried to explain the uncertainty to which faith is an answer has got nothing to do with the origins of the universe. That's not the subject of the Bible. Nothing to do with the things that are scientific, but science has not yet understood. It is the uncertainty of the future which we redeem by knowing that we face it not alone. I know of no more moving description of faith, no more revolutionary description of faith than that is a covenant of love between God and the human race. The idea that we exist not by accident, that we as a race and as individuals are purposefully created by God, and that God invites each one of us to enter into a special relationship. It's true that before God we bow the knee. It is not a relationship of equals, but nonetheless, every human being is built with the sensitivity, the knowledge that they're not alone in this universe. And, by the way, it therefore follows, and when I ask the question, what does God want from me? First of all, to know that my life is not an accident, that my life is purposeful, that I'm built and created for a reason, and that reason is ultimately to be part of existence, to be God's co-inhabitor, roommate, if you like, in the universe. It's a moral imperative as well, because being created by God and, as the Bible puts it, B'Tselem Elohim, not a rabbinic phrase, a biblical phrase, implies that we are God-like as well. That is a moral imperative, and therefore it leads, as we find in Source 10, a famous statement of the rabbis, Abba Shaul Omer Ve'anvehu, Havidomilo, Mahu Chanun V'Rachum, Afatu Haya Chanun V'Rachum. Human beings created in the image of God have an imperative to act in ways that are godly. Every human being. We have a duty. And before we talk about Torah legislation, mitzvot of B'nai Noach, mitzvot of the Jewish people, before we talk about any of that, ritual law, moral law, there is this baseline of what it means our responsibility as creatures, as created beings of God, is to exercise and radiate compassion to everything else in creation. Just like God is the creator of love and benevolent, chanun v'rachum, so we have to be. It also means that the knowledge of knowing that we're not alone and we're not accidental and that we're created creatures has another moral imperative as well. Those of you studying Daf Yomi will, without giving too much away, will come across the following passage in the Talmud. We'll read it in English very quickly. We'll come across this in about approximately a week's time. The Gemara tells the story of the death of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great leader of the Jewish people around the destruction of the Second Temple, is on his deathbed. And his students come to him and they ask him for a blessing. And they say to him, our teacher, bless us. He said to them, it's actually better in Hebrew, so I'm going to read it in Hebrew. Yehi ratzon shitei mor shamayim alechem kamore basar vadam. May it be that you be as afraid of heaven, as in awe and reverent of heaven as you are of your fellow human being. Amru lo tamida vadkan. That's the blessing you're giving us, that our fear of God should be as much as our fear of a human being. That's not a great blessing. Amar lahem elavai. I wish it were that much. Teda kisha adam over avera omer shelo yereini adam. After all, when any human being does an avera, does a sin, we want to make sure that nobody can see us. And we forget that God can see us. We're supposed to live a life of God consciousness, of knowing that we are accountable, knowing that we live in the sight, constantly in the sight, with the expectations and yes, the demands of a being to whom our lives are one day supposed to be accountable. It also means, to finish, it also means, as opposed to the grim view that says that life is an accident, that life is meaningful and therefore joyous. I have two versions of this quote, one from the author of Mesilat Yesharim, who maintains that the purpose of creation is to derive pleasure from the radiance of the Shekhinah. God creates us so we can know joy. He says, ultimately, the real joy is in the world to come. That's not a cop-out, because that's permanent joy. By definition, if your definition of heavenly rewards is a rib steak, then at the end of the day, you can only eat so many rib steaks. Before you know it, you're going to be sick of ribs. So ultimately, true bliss and joy is an eternal good, which can only be enjoyed in eternity. That's a separate argument. But the Ramcha, the beginning of Mesilas Yesharim, and if people ever study the path of the just, Mesilas Yesharim and Yeshiva will know that it's a fierce, demanding Musar book. And it's all about how we all got to shape up. That's at least the way I remember it being taught to me. But it starts with the following idea. Human beings are created by loving God to experience profound joy. I look around the room because last year, 2 years ago, when I gave my first of my Elul series, we had a class on Simon Wiesenthal, and we were talking about forgiveness. So not entirely off topic, I quoted a, who's that person that wrote the book about Simon, who wrote the Sunflower? He wrote, Simon Wiesenthal wrote, and he sent around the book asking, what would you have done to lots of religious leaders, including Christians, Jews, Catholics, etc.? And I quoted some of the responses. So there was somebody who came to the class who was deeply offended that in an Elul lecture I'd quoted a Catholic priest. So, but she's not here. So I didn't put it on the handout sheet. But I read an article recently in the British magazine, The Spectator. And one of the columnists in The Spectator magazine was writing about how they'd rediscovered the religious faith. In fact, this individual converted, as it happens, to Catholicism. And she quotes, have you seen the two popes? Yes. So she quotes Cardinal or former Pope Ratzinger about his own experience. And I quote this to show both the universality of faith, and this idea has got nothing at all that any orthodox, impeccably orthodox Jewish theologian could possibly disagree with. And Cardinal Ratzinger writes as follows, faith gives joy. When God is not there, and I firmly believe this. This isn't on your sheets because I didn't want to risk it. When God is not there, remember that line about your fear of heaven should be his fear? I'm working on that. When God is not there, the world becomes desolate and everything becomes boring and everything is completely unsatisfactory. It's easy to see today how a world empty of God is also increasingly consuming itself, how it has become a wholly joyless world. The great joy comes from the fact that there is this great love. And that is the essential message of faith. You are unswervingly loved. And I think people have the capacity, ultimately, if I were to talk about my own personal faith, I would say, in the words, and we'll look at this, a different quote in a moment, in the words of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and I just say as a side and almost as a kind of a boast, one of my greatest joys, certainly of my daughter's recent wedding, is the fact that my daughter's ketubah has the signature Moshe Ben Harav Aaron Lichtenstein on it. I cannot tell you how much that means to me personally. Aaron Lichtenstein, a giant. He wrote a piece, asked to write about faith for some early Jewish action symposium, wrote that ultimately the source of faith is faith itself. People who feel the presence of God in their life in a deeply personal way and have an intuition that they indeed are beloved, held, not alone in this universe. It doesn't necessarily answer why are, does that mean I have to keep Rabbeinu Tam time or not keep Rabbeinu Tam time, Chol of Israel, yes or no? Doesn't answer those questions at all. But the idea that one can intuit, again, in a way that is in no way scientifically irrational, that one's life means something, that this universe means something, that we're summoned into creation by a being who we will never understand, but who we can nonetheless detect the presence of in our lives, is the profoundest truth. And I want to say one last thing before I read this quote from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And that, there's no real quote, because it's what Jews believe. I started off with this comment about social orthodoxy and this comment about, you know, what it is that our religious practices mean to us. I firmly believe the presence of God in our lives, religious faith, demands a constant engagement. Religious faith is more than coming to shul for the last hour of services on Shabbat. I don't say that, and it's more than coming even at the beginning of coming and showing up at time on Shabbat morning. A religious life is supposed to be thick. It's supposed to be full. The Gemara in the Daf Yomi and Brachot just the other day asked the following question. Who is a Ben Olam Haba? Who will go? There are many answers to this question. Who will go ultimately to heaven? And the Gemara describes a day that is just full of religious consciousness. That's ultimately what Torah and mitzvot are about. That we constantly feel ourselves responsive to this creator, this source of faith in our life, the source of love in our life. The Gemara says one who wakes up, washes their hands, goes to the bathroom, washes their face, those are also considered mitzvot, to look after the body, put on talis and tefillin if you're a male, daven shema and shmona esrei. That's a ben olam haba. It's talking about, and this is really why I wanted to give this series and why it's more about just than faith, it's about practice as well. We're supposed to not push God to the margins of our lives, to live lives that are overwhelmingly secular and merely punctuated by moments of religious, strict obligation. A person who goes to work as a ma'amin, as a believer, who does their taxes as a believer, who stands up on the subway for somebody older and tired of themselves because mahu rachum afatati rachum, person who lives their lives fused with religious practices rooted in faith. That's what God wants from us. I'm as convinced of that as anything I can be. So let's finish with, to my mind, this beautiful, beautiful quote by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who more than any recent Rosh Hashiva I know spoke a lot about his own personal faith and engagement. And this is the last source on the sheet. And with this, we'll finish. Passionate belief has more than one source. Rav Aaron did not believe that you can choose the teleological, the cosmological, or any other arguments. It's complex. It arises from studying Torah, trusting in tradition, pondering the elaborate structure of the world and the vicissitudes of history, and personal experience. I do not believe that we need to choose between these sources. I believe that they're all interrelated, independent. Within the symphony, some elements dominate, but as a whole, they create the feeling of belief. You do not need to choose only one path. And he writes in another context that some things speak to some people and don't to others. There is nothing of which I'm more certain, more convinced, that I experience more deeply, feel more strongly than my faith. Now we can learn from Rav Aaron that this is how we should be. We can just have the insight into a sensitive soul. There is nothing that the believer feels more strongly than his faith, not at every moment and not with regard to every detail, but his very bond to the Almighty, this deep internal bond that exists at all times. It gives man might, fortitude, and contentment. Anyone who has lost his existential connection to the Almighty has experienced a complete collapse, a total unraveling. He's talking about the feeling of no longer being connected. To lose a connection with the Almighty is to lose one's raison d'etre, to lose the essence of life. It is catastrophic. If the loss befalls a particular society, woe to that society. What is life without this bond? And that, friends, in a nutshell, in an hour and 10-minute nutshell, is the sense of at least an overview, the beginning of a journey into understanding that faith, while deeply personal and mystical psychologically, is a language of the heart rather than the mind, is something which is rooted both in human consciousness and indeed surprisingly tenable in terms of the science and the physics of the world as it is understood today in the world in which we live. So Be'ezrat Hashem, I really invite all of you to join me in these coming weeks. You can come on Mondays at 1 o'clock, you can come on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock, as we next week will explore the particular role of the Jewish people in world history, chosen and what we're chosen for. And together, hopefully, we will build for our community and in our own lives a deeper and a more positive and a holier connection and holier experience of faith. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.